Welcome to Criminal Thinking Deterred with your host, Tony Moore. Here we talk about how to take responsibility for your decisions, stop hurting people, become a positive force in your community, and end the criminal thinking that deters everyone.
We're here today talking to our great friend, Guida Brown, and I'm honored to have her presence here today. We want to begin by talking about the epidemic that we're having in our country with fentanyl and how it's just devastating our country, Canada, and other places around the world from the usage and the deaths of it is just alarming. I'll give you a chance, Guida. Give us a little background about yourself and who you are. And again, thank you for coming on and talk to us about this.
Well, thanks, Tony. Thanks for having me on. I'm really happy to be here. And I'm really happy that you recognize my expertise because I worked really hard at it. And then I sort of went away and, you fade off into the sunset and no one remembers you. So that's my background. I spent 13 years as executive director of the Hope Council on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse. I retired about 2 years ago and didn't want to pull all of that experience out of the community. So I've tried to stay involved. I'm still involved with the Kenosha County Substance Abuse Coalition. And I started a consultancy called Guided by Guida, where I work primarily regarding drug testing, direct biomarker, fingernails and hair and blood spots. And I also do a podcast, a blog, The Four C's of Addiction. I stay up on that pretty regularly. So I think that you asked for my background.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
So there you go. There you have it.
Yeah. Well, let me start off by saying, you know, I learned a lot from you when you were the director of Hope Council because your knowledge was so freely giving it to anybody in the community that would want the information concerning how drug addiction.
I got to stop you there, Tony. I gave it to anybody, right? I gave it to everybody who didn't want to know about it, right? I was doing intoxicated driver program assessments. And I can tell you, there were a lot of people who didn't want to know. And that to me is a shame, right? We're not doing a good job of explaining to people about the disease of addiction. And I mean, we, the professionals, and I think we have, and you and I know are on the same page of this, right? We have changed our language so much that it just is a jumble of words and means nothing anymore. I'm not suggesting that there should be stigma. I'm not suggesting that we should call people addicts and alcoholics. I am suggesting that when we talk about them having a disease, they should have a name for it. They should know that you have addiction and that is a chronic progressive lethal disease, not you have a substance use disorder. So there was a move up about for seriously like 30 seconds because the federal government and IAAA came up with an idea to use the term pre-addiction. We should use the term pre-addiction for those people who are on a slippery slope or, you know, okay. So they floated that and they asked for people's input and overwhelmingly people, the professionals said, absolutely not, absolutely not. So I was at a conference with the director of the NIAAA. He was presenting. He doesn't know me from Adam, you know, it's a big conference. And I went up to him afterwards and I said, Dr. Koo, when do we get to start talking about addiction? And he said, well, I'm not really that worried about the words. And I said, well, see, here's the thing. When you have prediabetes, if you leave it untreated, you get diabetes.
Yes.
If you have pre-cancer and you leave it untreated, you get cancer.
Yes.
If you have pre-addiction and you leave it untreated, you don't get a substance use disorder.
Yes. You get addiction.
You get addiction. And this idea that you've got mild, moderate, and severe substance use disorder, and people don't even know what that means. And I just feel like the people who have it, the people who are suffering from it, their loved ones, people are dying from it. And we're like, oh, you've got a substance use disorder. It's like, And I have a friend who says, oh, I don't have addiction, right? So I'm not an alcoholic. They want to know those words because we haven't done a good job of educating them about those words being the same thing, or just giving them a tool to say having a severe substance use disorder is the same thing as having addiction, and addiction is a disease. It's
Yes.
a chronic, progressive, lethal disease, just like diabetes, just like cancer, just like heart disease. And we've done a terrible job of that. And I'm sorry I took you off on a tangent, but
No, no.
yeah.
That's
So I am willing to educate anybody, especially the people who don't want to be educated, because
so.
I really think we're the problem. I really think we, the professionals, are the problem in so many cases on this.
So how do we change our perception on this fentanyl use and how it's killing people? We know alcohol has killed people. We know cigarettes have killed a lot of people. But this fentanyl thing, I was studying last night, and it said 72,000 people died last year from fentanyl use in America. That's not even counting Canada and other places. In America, 72,000 people. That's epidemic.
It is, and a little tangent again. Alcohol still killed more people. So addiction is a disease, right? You know the theory of we can't save everybody as they're coming down the river. We can't, the baby comes down the river and somebody goes in and jumps in and grabs one baby, and then all of a sudden, five babies come, and now this one person can't save the five babies. And so you get more people at the end of the river to try to jump in and save those babies. And then suddenly the babies are coming down so fast, nobody can save them. We have to go figure out who's throwing the babies in the river, right?
Yes.
We have to stop it up there. We cannot treat or incarcerate our way out of this problem. We have to stop it at the beginning. So I think the question is, why do we have so many people in the United States who want to live in an alternate reality?
Okay. So if that's the case, why do we have so many people in an alternate reality? What is it that the opiate do to for them? Is
Right.
it the pain relief? Is there so many people in pain that they don't understand pain, or our doctors are
Yeah,
misguided?
no. I think it's all of the above, Tony. I think part of it is we don't want to be in pain. And Mike Gravely, our Kenosha district attorney, and we used to call it the opioid tour. We would go out on the road show, the opioid road show. And we would go out as a pair and talk to anybody who wanted to listen to us. So we talked to every Rotary Club and Kiwanis and Optimists and every women's organization, everyone who would want to listen to us. And we would go and we would do this presentation, and we had it down so good. It was funny. I watched a monologue of like John Oliver, and he had all the same talking points, and I was like, wow, he stole our material. We had it down really, really well. If my grandfather knew that there was an expectation of ever living a life free from pain, he would roll over in his grave. And I think that's the problem. I think once opioids came to be and came to be so freely used, and I have another story about that. Of course, I have another story about that. Once they came to be so freely used, we stopped believing that we should have any pain at all. So in 1987, my father was dying from cancer, and my father suffered from lifelong addiction, and he went into the hospital 2 weeks before, but he was in active addiction when he went into the hospital. And he was diagnosed with lung cancer that had metastasized to his brain. So he's in the hospital. He had a stroke a couple days into the hospital stay, and so he's lying in the bed and he's paralyzed on his left side. And my maternal aunt is in the hospital room with us. And she says to the nurse, "Can you give him something for pain? He looks like he's in pain." And the nurse says, And I just, this is just hysterical to me. So my father is in the hospital dying from cancer. He's had a stroke. He has a lifelong addiction. And the nurse says to my aunt, well, you know that morphine is addictive.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, so fast forward now to 30 years. And Karen Van Heineken, she used to be my work wife. I used to say this all the time. She would get so mad at me. Fast forward 30 years from my dad being in the hospital and unable to get morphine because he's dying of cancer. We now give basically pill form of morphine to anyone who has a hangnail. And so we did a good job in around 2012 to sort of dial that back. But we still get opioids pretty easily. People like them.
Yes.
People like not feeling the pain of whatever they got the opioid for. And they also don't feel any other pain, right? So we know that when somebody first gets off of using opioids, one of the first problems they have is their teeth. Because they have neglected their care for so long, and they don't feel all the pain. So you know, the kid who got the knee surgery because of the basketball injury when he was in high school, now, you know, fast forward even 5 years, everything's destroyed on him because he's never felt pain. But pain is our body's message to say, hey, pay attention to me, do something about this.
Exactly.
So teeth are a mess, and this is a mess, and that's a mess. So it doesn't, that opioids are really good because they attack pain. They don't fix pain, they just cover it. And yes, the examples I could give you, Tony, my husband was in the hospital, and we know that you shouldn't give opioids to anybody who's over 60, but he had heart surgery. I'm not suggesting he shouldn't have gotten opioids, but they gave him opioids. He was a different person. And, you know, I had to say he then about a week later, he had to go back into the hospital after being discharged because the recovery wasn't working right. And I had to tell him, you do not accept any opioids. And he's like, aren't you going to be with me in the hospital? So we go into the hospital. He gets checked into the hospital. We go in and I say, he doesn't want any opioids. Literally a day later, he's having pain. Again, he's had a lot of pain.
Yes.
He had his lungs had filled up with fluid. He's having pain. They said, do you want some morphine? I said, no, he doesn't want any morphine. I don't want to go through this anymore. I don't want to go through, you know, literally doling it out, arguing about when. And that's the other problem with it. It's so addictive. It's so addictive. And so this idea that you can just get it and then you're just going to be off of it is really problematic. And I'm not suggesting everybody who gets it becomes addicted to it. We know that that is not the case. But we also know that there are a lot of people who have addiction. And
yes,
addiction
yes.
is not, you're not addicted to a substance. You're not addicted to opioids. You're not addicted to alcohol. You have the disease of addiction. I always liken it to my sister has diabetes. And there's not a doctor in the world who's going to say, you know what? You have diabetes, so stop eating donuts, but eat as much bread as you want to. You know, donuts are cocaine and bread is heroin. It doesn't work that way. They say, you have diabetes, control your diet. We say, you have addiction, control the things that you're putting into your body or
yes,
the things that you're doing that are compulsive. And, you know, so the addictive nature of it is part of the huge problem. We wouldn't have this problem if opioids weren't as addictive as they are. And then once you're addicted to them, we know then you move to heroin. And the issue with heroin, so heroin's been around forever. Only those people used to use heroin because you had to inject it. And it was, you know, back alley kind of stuff. Once it started coming over the cocaine lines from South America into Mexico, into, you know, South America, Central America, Mexico, into
yes,
us, it became much more pure. So now I don't have to inject it. I can simply snort it. And it's white and it looks like cocaine. And so it's much more palatable. It's much more agreeable to just snort it. And so Carrie Pines, she's a wonderful recovery coach in town. She yes. talks about how she used to say, I would tell myself, I don't have a problem unless I get an OWI. Oops, I got an OWI. I don't have a problem unless I use cocaine. Oops, I use cocaine. I don't have a problem unless I use heroin. Oops, I use heroin. I don't have a problem unless I shoot up. And then she shot up and she was like, okay, you know, I'm out of excuses. But how many people have I heard say, you know, my loved one has a heroin addiction, but he's not shooting up. And I'm like, yeah, he is. Yeah, he is. If it's risen yes. to the level that you recognize it, he's shooting up. But we just saw the study that says now with the fentanyl, we're back to snorting it. And that scares the bejesus out of me because the snorting is so much more acceptable to people, right? No one in the world wakes up in the morning and says, today's the first day I'm going to shoot up heroin. No one says that. Today's the first day I'm going to shoot up, period. No one says that. It just happens.
Yes.
And when you know that fentanyl is killing people who are snorting it, that bar has, I think those deaths are going to go way up because we could keep people away from shooting up because it was just scary. And people that, you know, I hate needles. I would never stick a needle in my arm. There's a difference. And I think now those numbers are going to, I think they're going to skyrocket. I really do because it's just so pure and it's just so accessible. That's the other problem, the accessibility of it.
So how do you feel about the harm reduction part about it, offering needles for HIV, hepatitis C, and all the other things that they think they're preventing crime and so forth and so on, and they have studies that echo their success from using that approach. What do you think about that?
Again, going back to now the new study that says fentanyl's being snorted and people are dying, I think that's going to impact the response of the harm reduction. I think harm reduction makes sense. I think, though, that we've used that language for harm reduction. Harm reduction was designed specifically for opioids, and it was mm-hmm. the clean needles, the Narcan, there's one other thing, three things specifically for opioids. And then we use that language to embrace everything. And now everything is harm reduction. And I think that's a huge problem. And again, from the professionals in this field, when we say that it's harm reduction to use marijuana because you used to use heroin, that's not harm reduction. All you did was switch to a less deadly drug, and that's good, but that's not harm reduction. I had a colleague, Abigail Winsack, she always said, harm reduction still means harm.
Yes.
And so if people understand that, that's great, but I don't think people understand that. So there's this expectation that, well, I made this little step and now, you know, now I'm good because that was harm reduction. It's like, it doesn't work that way. So the needles, the Narcan, I'm fine with that. I wish more people understood. I carry Narcan. I change purses, so my purse is too small, but I did carry Narcan and I was trained in it. And then mm-hmm. every single person I saw sleeping looked like a person who was having an overdose. And so it makes people more aware. So even if you never use it, it makes people more aware. And I think that improves our society. You know, I don't want a safe injection site in my community. I don't yes. want, I have grandkids and I don't want to have to tell my grandkids, let's not walk down that street. That's where people are injecting drugs. But giving them clean needles if they need clean needles and giving them Narcan so they don't die, giving their loved ones Narcan so they, you know, the other person doesn't die. I'm okay with that. again, that is way too late in the game, right? That is way too late in the game. Once you're overdosing and we need Narcan to save you, you're down the river. We need to get up here and figure out why you're jumping in the water. And that's what it is, right? We're not throwing babies in the water anymore. People are jumping in the water willingly, and they don't know how to swim. And they're getting caught up in this horrible current, and then they're dying at the end of it. And so we have to figure out, why are you jumping into the water? What, as a society, have we done wrong to make you want to jump into the water?
So when you talk about jumping in the water, what level or what theory of treatment would you suggest for opiate using people? Is it education? Is it a therapeutic approach? Is it media? What, or is it all of that?
For people who are already using, I think education and therapy. And you know, and that's another part of the problem, Tony. How many times have we heard people say, we don't have any treatment in Kenosha? And it's like, No. You've got treatment in Kenosha. We don't have the kind of treatment you think you want because you think somehow you're special. And so my sister-in-law had cancer and succumbed to it. And I use her as the example. She did not spend her life in the hospital getting treatment. I don't know how we got this idea that people who have substance use disorders, people who have addiction, deserve to be in, I don't mean deserve, are required to be in this environment where everything around them is controlled. When my sister-in-law suffered from cancer and had to live out in her own house on her own and figure stuff out, and the only time she got put into the hospital was when she had an emergent condition. And we've somehow conflated that to think that withdrawal, being sick, is an emergent condition. It's not an emergent condition. Withdrawal from alcohol might be, withdrawal from benzodiazepines might be, yep. But withdrawal from heroin or opioids, that is not an emergent condition. You're sick as a dog, and you're going to stay sick as a dog for a while, but you're not going to die from that. And so people don't want to be sick as a dog. And so I don't know how to convince them. I think that's the piece of it. How do you convince people that their lives will be better off if they stopped using when that initial couple of weeks is so awful? So Vivitrol, we know Vivitrol causes people to go into an immediate withdrawal. And I don't believe it's being used this way, but I don't know that it would be such a terrible thing to use it. So you have to be free from opioids for 5 days, 7 days, 3 days, I'm not positive, before you can get a Vivitrol injection.
Is that the same as Suboxone?
No, it's not, which is, so Suboxone will sort of wean you off, but you still have to get off of it before you can get a Vivitrol injection. So you still have to stay off of it. So that, and same with methadone. Methadone will, you know, obviously. So you have to stay off of all opioids in order to have a Vivitrol injection.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's so fine. But what here, so if I'm worried about withdrawal, give them the injection. They stay sick as a dog for a shorter period of time. They plan it. You know, I'm like, just give them the injection because we know they're going to go into withdrawal. Give them the injection and then mediate their problems, the withdrawal issues, instead of making them withdraw on their own. Because that's, I think that's part of the problem too. That, and again, it's probably not medically sound. I'm not a doctor, but if so, that Dr. Galbus Rudge, he talks about how people who suffer from alcoholism, they're used to being sick all the time, right? Because you always have hangovers, and the hair of the dog is what keeps you away from being sick, but they're used to being sick all the time. So they detox for like a day and they're like, no, doc, I'm fine. I'm leaving. And you're like, well, no, you're not fully detoxed. No, I'm good. He says people who have opioid use disorder, they'll call him like 6 months later. They haven't used, and they're like, doc, I need something. And he's like, what are your symptoms? Anxiety. And again, it's because opioids make us feel good. 100%, our entire bodies, we feel good. Alcohol doesn't do that. Alcohol, you're ingesting a poison. It makes you feel sick if you have too much of it. Mm-hmm. And we're not paying attention to that. So we have some tools. I think we've spent so much energy in this community, in this country, on opioids because we have better tools to address them.
Mm. So you know, is that a funding thing? We give more funding than other countries to our addictive issues?
Well, I don't know that answer. I doubt it. But I will tell you that we are one of two countries that advertise drugs in public, advertise mm-hmm. drugs on television. So think about that, the effect of that. New Zealand is the only other country. So when I go to the doctor and my toe hurts, and the doctor says, get out of here, go take some ibuprofen. And now I get to report that my doctor didn't pay attention to me and his insurance rating goes down and all of that goes on to that. My doctor is more than willing to give me opioids because my toe hurts. And I saw it on TV and I get to say, no, the ibuprofen's not gonna, I've tried ibuprofen, it's not gonna work. I need that thing I saw on TV. And it has been brilliant for the pharmaceutical companies. So my point is when the pharmaceutical companies, so when the people we paid all this, you know, who caused the majority of our problem, when they figured out how to make themselves make more money by selling us Vivitrol and by selling us Narcan, we then were like, oh, look, we've got a solution. We've got Vivitrol, we've got Narcan. Instead of saying, again, let's spend a lot of money up here making sure people don't jump in the water. You know, everyone's not going to die. That's why addiction is a disease. You're not addicted to one thing. If you were addicted to one thing and we took all opioids off the face of the earth, you still have an addiction. The problem is that opioids killed us fast. And so when people started dropping dead fast, we started paying attention. And then when the pharmaceutical company said, here's a solution for dropping dead fast, here's Narcan, then we're like, okay, we all pat ourselves on the back. Look at what a good job we did in our community, in our state, in our country, that we have a solution for addiction.
Well, you actually had a Band-Aid.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
And when you extend propaganda to any marketing or advertisement, when you use it well or see it used well, Big Pharma or whatever they call it will use it to still make money, because the bottom line become capitalism and money when you're talking about fentanyl. Fentanyl was made and designed because it was cheaper and lighter and easier to smuggle and more uses, but it's so potent that 1 grain or gram of it can kill you. There's no education about the harmful effects of what fentanyl is. When you touch it, it can kill you.
Yeah, if you touch it and do something else. Yeah. Yeah. Once it gets into your system, yep, it can kill you. And you're right. We've done but I also think the flip side of, I'm not coming in contact with fentanyl, right? Mm-hmm. You're not coming in contact with fentanyl. So the scare tactics for people who basically have no sense of fear because they're in white water rapid that's rushing down this, you know, what are you trying to tell them? You might die. Yeah, I know. I might die anyway. Like there's no, so they're not getting it. We're scaring people. The fentanyl and marijuana story makes me insane. I hear it every couple of months, maybe every 3-4 months. Fentanyl, there's fentanyl in marijuana, right? And I go, no, there's not. Yeah, no, I heard it one time at band camp. I always say that one time at band camp. And I'm like, no, there's not fentanyl in marijuana. And then law enforcement will come along and say, yes, we have a official case of fentanyl and marijuana. And I'm like, no, you don't. You used a field drug test. They are notoriously inaccurate. Mm-hmm. So now you're spreading this rumor. And when that happens, the people who are affected by it know it's not true. And then it ruins that whole story. You know, it's the boy who cried wolf.
Yes.
And so I've explained to a couple politicians. I've explained to a lot of people. I have a contact with the state hygiene lab. They do all the testing for the drugs. Every 6 months, I email her and I say, hey, Amy, it's my six month question. Any fentanyl showing up in marijuana and cannabis? And she says, no, there's not. There never has been. We've never had one case at the state hygiene lab that has been fentanyl and marijuana, not one case. And she's talked to other states, not one case. And the story of that is, well, we did a field test. Yeah, but your field tests are notoriously inaccurate. And I said, and I'm not suggesting there's not fentanyl around. I am telling you that no one is lacing marijuana with fentanyl, because we would have body bags lining our streets. We would all know, right? There's no way. There's the people who are using marijuana alone have no tolerance for fentanyl. They would drop dead so fast it would make our heads spin.
Yeah. Yeah,
I agree. It doesn't exist. And so then you have that one person who says, no, officer, I swear I was only using marijuana and I overdosed on fentanyl. And it's like, okay, because people who abuse drugs are super honest all the time, aren't they? And that should be taken as the gospel truth.
Yeah,
and it's tedious. But again, the flip side of that is now you're crying wolf. You're the boy crying wolf, and the people who know think you're full of garbage, and you're not. It's not, you know, your message is really missing its point because they're not listening to you, because it's just, they know you're full of garbage. They know you're full of it. So we have to do a better job educating.
Yeah, and me as a community provider in substance abuse, mental health. What would you suggest to me to start legislating to Congress, Senate, and whoever else will listen to me, what we need for our community? What would you advise me to start researching and understanding what to do?
Primary prevention in our schools. We need primary prevention in our schools. We have done a terrible job We've done a terrible job educating people about the dangers of addiction, the dangers of substances. In the high schools, they have a health class, and traditionally their entire curriculum is on the alcohol and other drug aspect is they tell each kid to take a drug, to take a drug topic. Mm-hmm. And then the kid comes and writes a report and then presents that report to the class. And it doesn't matter if it's right or wrong, because nobody has the knowledge to tell the kid if it's right or wrong. That's not good education, right? That is not good education. We have to do a better job with primary prevention. From day one, you know, we have the DARE program, and the DARE program has gone through a lot of changes, and it's a fine program, but we can't scattershot it. We can't say, oh, this school has it, that school doesn't. And they can't do it 1 year and then say, we're done with education, we're done with prevention.
Yes.
We need an ongoing primary prevention program in our schools, all of them. And how we have just dropped the ball on that is mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling to me.
When you're growing up, everybody knows that sex is a topic, drugs is a topic, but nobody want to talk about it. We know that it's impacting our communities. We know it's impacting our families but it's the two conversations that we just don't talk about that need to be talked about. We hide it up under the porch. Let's talk about it out back. but we never have that face-to-face, sit at the table. Let's find out reasons and ways to deal with what we actually are, our reality. Our reality is we're having babies, we're having drug usage, we're having this, money issues. Let's talk about it. We don't open up and talk about the things that cause us problems. We hide from
them. I have a huge issue. I think we are a conflict-averse nation, right? That's why we're shooting each other, because we don't know how to deal with conflict. We're a conflict-averse nation. So if we taught children how to address conflict, we would be so much farther ahead. I can't tell you how many times I've had to have these conversations with people. We don't want to have these conversations. They're uncomfortable. Well, yeah, of course they're uncomfortable.
Yes.
But big deal. Big deal. You still have to be able to talk about them. And we just don't. You're right. We're not going to talk about it. I'm not going to address it. Why? And especially with addiction. You know, I always use the example. If you go to the gym every single day, there's this guy in front of you and he's stripping down, because that's what men do in the gym locker. Mm-hmm. And he strips down and he's got a mole on his back, and the mole gets bigger and bigger and bigger during the time that you're there. And you don't really know the guy, but you see this mole growing. A human being goes up to the guy and goes, "Hey, I know you can't see it, but you've got this great big mole on your back. You might want to get a check for skin cancer." There was a case of a news anchor in Florida, and she was on the air doing like the weather, and a viewer wrote in and said, "Hey, I noticed you have a lump on your neck."
Yes.
"I had a lump like that on my neck, and it turned out to be thyroid cancer. You should get it checked." And the woman got it checked, and she had thyroid cancer, and she got treatment, and she was better. And she, of course, was appreciative to that viewer who wrote in, who she didn't know. And I said, so we can address these things with strangers, but we have loved ones who we will ignore that we see this problem. I think the other thing we've done in this country, we sold our soul to the alcohol industry. So around 1987, 1989, our government promised the alcohol industry that they would no longer talk about alcohol and other drugs. So now alcohol has been removed as a drug because it's legal and it's accessible. And so we have given such misinformation to our communities. The next thing will happen with cannabis, right? When cannabis is fully legalized, we won't talk about cannabis as a drug because it's legal and it's safe because, you know, it doesn't kill you, right? And so the messaging is just so off base, and it's unfortunate, but we need to do primary prevention. We need to stop them from jumping into the rapids.
Yes. So in wrapping up, what would you say for you that you want to see happen moving forward with the fentanyl use? And I know that you retired now, and you brought a lot to the field and gave a lot to the field, but you still got a lot of passion, and you can see it and you can hear it. What would you say we should do?
I think, oh gosh, Tony, that's a hard one. You know, I always hope that people are smarter than I am or are dealing with these problems. And then I wonder if they're, education. We're, you know, they're sending it to us in the mail, right? Our mails have now become our drug lines. So to pretend that we're going to be able to prevent this from coming into this country is nonsense. It's just absolute nonsense. So we have to do a better job of educating people to not want to go down that path.
Yes. Well, I thank you very much, Guida. It's been very informative. As always, you're passionate and knowledgeable about the field. I love talking to you every time I get a chance. And I want to thank you and have you come back on again at some time. As we move down the road, this is Criminal Thinking Deterred, and we have had our good friend, Guida Brown, and my executive producer, Philip Day. bringing you an interesting topic in our community that's dealing with a lot of pain and a lot of issues, fentanyl use in America. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Criminal Thinking Deterred with Tony Moore. Visit our website, www.criminalthinking.net. Follow Criminal Thinking on Facebook and Instagram. Also, listen, follow, and download Criminal Thinking Deterred on the major podcast channels. Thank you, and have a productive day.